This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by Verizon, the network America relies on.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hey, everybody. Good morning and welcome to the Washington Post. I'm Tony Rahm, the economic policy and accountability reporter here at the Post. And I'm really thrilled to be here to talk about the digital divide with none other than FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel. Hey, Chairwoman, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thank you, Tony, for having me. And thank you to the Washington Post for setting up this discussion.
Yeah, thanks, everybody, for being here. So I want to launch right into it. We have so much to discuss. The government is doing so much on the issue of the digital divide. But I got to start with the news of the day. I don't even think it's been 24 hours since the FCC voted on net neutrality. Those are the rules that require internet providers to treat all web traffic equally. We've been here many, many times before with rules that have been implemented and then scrapped and then implemented again. So what's different this time around? What's it actually going to mean for consumers?
I think it's really important to remember that it was 4 years ago that the pandemic started. And we were all told to go home, hunker down, and live life online. And something really changed in this country. We recognize that broadband's an essential service, that you don't have a fair shot in modern life if you don't have broadband at home. And a curious thing happened, though, which is during the last administration, there was a decision made to not have oversight over broadband, and as part of that, not have net neutrality rules, which are very popular. They mean that your broadband provider can't make decisions for you about where you go and what you do online. Net neutrality rules prevent them from setting up fast lanes for some services and slow lanes for others. So the last administration took those rules away. Some states stepped into the breach and built their own rules. And I felt strongly that in the aftermath of the pandemic, which made so clear that broadband's an essential service, we should have a national net neutrality policy. And that's what the FCC brought back yesterday.
I want to get to the broadband access issue in a second, but just as a follow-up there, I think the argument from the telecom companies is, even in the absence of strong federal rules in this space, there wasn't a whole lot of bad stuff happening online, right? We didn't see these widespread reports that internet providers were blocking and slowing web traffic. So why are these rules needed?
Well, I think the important thing is something I just mentioned, that when Washington stepped out, states stepped in. We have net neutrality policies in California, Washington, all in all, nearly a dozen states developed their own net neutrality policies. And so they've been governing web traffic. But I think in a modern digital economy, we need one national policy, and that's what we did yesterday.
Right. So the bigger issue here, obviously, is broadband access, and your agency obviously sits right at the center of that. And you all have been at work for a long time now in trying to figure out who does and doesn't have connectivity. So as we sit here in 2024, what's your progress report? Looking at the maps, looking at the data, what's the latest state of connectivity in the United States?
We're making real progress, but we still have work to do. One of the most important things that the Federal Communications Commission has done that doesn't always get the attention it deserves is we really upgraded our maps about who has service and who doesn't. We used something like 200 different data sources, tax records, property records, to develop maps of every buildable location in the United States. And then every 6 months, we go to carriers and ask them to help tell us where they provide service. And then we turn around to consumers and we say, does this look right to you? You can change these maps if you tell us we got something wrong. And as a result, we've been able to identify with far greater accuracy than ever before that there are 7 to 8 million households that don't have service in this country. And there are many other households that have what we call underserved. They might have service, but it's at slower speeds than we think are really necessary for full participation in modern digital life.
How confident are we in the accuracy of those maps? I know that there were a significant number of challenges at one point, questioning whether the locations on there did indeed have service. So how do you feel about the accuracy?
I think those challenges are terrific. They're part of the process. The whole process is designed to be iterative. We put out what we have, and we turn to the public and say, is this right? Is this wrong? Help us improve it. And we're going to be doing that every 6 months going forward. And I think the goal is to make sure that we can identify where we're making progress, where we're falling behind, and what communities are really still stuck on the wrong side of the digital divide.
How much of this, in your mind, is a question of the availability of wires and wireless signals versus the fact that some Americans simply can't afford the service that's in their backyard? How much does affordability factor into that?
That is such a good way to think about it. I think we have to recognize that the digital divide has two fundamental components. The first is that infrastructure issue we've been talking about with maps. We've got some rural, remote, and sometimes urban communities where that infrastructure is just not present. We've got to fix that. And in the bipartisan infrastructure law and many other COVID-era pieces of legislation, there's been funds to help do that. But the second part of the digital divide, the one you alluded to, is just as important. We have households that want to have broadband but cannot consistently afford it. And so the FCC has been able to develop a program called the Affordable Connectivity Program during the last several years to get those households online, to help them afford it, and make sure low-cost broadband's available to all those households who might want it but are just struggling to pay the bills and get online and stay online.
Right. I want to talk at length about the ACP program, as you mentioned. But before I do, is there a, you know, universal theory as to why broadband is the way it is in this country? I get so many messages from people who can't figure out why their bills are so high, can't figure out why their service is unreliable. I know the ISPs would obviously have a much different viewpoint about the availability of their services. But the message that we often get is that broadband is bad in the United States. Is that indeed the truth?
I think,
and why is it like that?
First of all, let's acknowledge in the United States, we are a vast and diverse country. We have urban centers like where we are right now, where there are lots of people in living in dense ways that make the deployment of networks and competitive networks easier. And we've got vast rural and remote areas that are extremely costly to serve. But the way I look at it is that we faced these challenges before. There was a time when we thought it was impossible to get electricity to everyone in this country. It was just going to be too expensive. You know, but we made decisions with the Rural Electrification Act to spend money to get it to rural communities, to improve it across the board. There was also a time when the idea of having basic phone service everywhere seemed out of reach. But we were able to achieve that. And to me, broadband's the same. We're just in a period of time where we've got to figure out how to get it to everyone everywhere. And along the way, see how much we can do to increase competition, because we know that competition lowers prices.
Right, so we have the Affordable Connectivity Program. That's the monthly subsidy that the U.S. government provides towards low-income families that they can put towards their broadband bills. But that benefit, at least as of right now, is going away. So we're staring at the possibility that May could be that final month of partial payments. What's going to happen in May and June? What do you anticipate this is going to mean for millions of people?
So let's point out that this is a program, the biggest broadband affordability effort in our nation's history to help solve the digital divide. The agency I oversee runs it. We've got 23 million households, about one in six households nationwide that count on it. It's a lot. And we think this program's been really, really successful. But it needs more funding from Congress. The full funding of this program will run out in April, though households can get some support in May. And what we've noticed is there's a lot of support for this program. In a town where we are often divided on things, we've got bipartisan bills in both the House and Senate to continue to fund this program. Senator Cantwell just introduced a spectrum bill that she's going to have marked up next week that includes funding for the Affordable Connectivity Program. We've got governors and mayors from across the country supporting it. I'm an optimist, and I believe that if you have that broad base of support, you're onto something. So we're going to keep pressing forward to make sure that this program stays funded. And while April is the last month of full funding for this program, May will make sure that those households get some support. So I think we have a little more runway and a little more time.
Mm-hmm. You're an optimist. Maybe I'm not so much of an optimist. And I having
public
been...
servant journalist.
Right. And having but also being on Capitol
I'm
Hill.
Just saying optimists get things done. But, you know, hey.
But does Capitol Hill get things done? I mean, I guess the question here is, what are you expecting in June? Are we going to see a world in which millions of people can no longer afford their internet service and they're going to be kicked off of their internet plans?
You know, we should be worried about it. The FCC did some data survey work on this, and we found that 77% of the households that rely on this program say that if the program came to an end, they'd have to reconsider service or shut it off entirely. I think that's devastating. Those are people who may not be able to keep up with work. Their kids may not be able to keep up with school. They might not be able to take those follow-up healthcare appointments that have migrated to online visits. Mm-hmm. And I think our communities are clearly stronger when everyone's connected. And that's why I think this program is so important. We're going to keep on keeping on to make sure Congress knows that.
Does the FCC have any power or tools at its disposal to act in the absence of Congress? I know there have been suggestions that maybe the commission could redirect funds, somehow use the Universal Service Fund. I think there are emergency petitions that ask for you all to intervene in some way. Is there a way for the FCC to do that, and is that something under consideration?
We do have more limited programs under what you describe as the Universal Service Fund. In particular, we have a program called Lifeline that offers about $10 a month of support. But one of the challenges is about half the households in the Affordable Connectivity Program are getting their service from carriers that are not qualified for the Lifeline program. So we're staring down in the near term at the possibility of losing a lot of households who rely on these connections.
But is there any way for the FCC to do anything to intervene in the absence of Congress?
We'll have to go back and take a look at that. But one of my concerns is that the Universal Service Fund is already under a lot of strain. Mm-hmm. And were we to expand it to bring this program in, we would substantially increase broadband bills for average households across this country and put the burden of paying for that fund on the typical household that gets broadband. And I don't think that's an acceptable shift. So we're going to keep talking to Congress about this.
Yeah, that's a great segue to my next question, because I guess the bigger picture issue here is who should pay for this stuff. Should it be on taxpayers? Should it be on telecom companies? Should it include internet providers or technology giants that, you know, provide or run on these networks? Who should be paying to ensure that the lowest income families in this country can afford access to the internet?
So I want to start with the proposition that I think when every household is connected, our communities and our economy is stronger. It is valuable for us to do that as a nation. And so I think everyone you just mentioned should be part of that program. I think that updating the law to reflect that is a really good idea. And there's bipartisan conversation in Congress about how to update the Universal Service Fund that is really about saying, how do we look at this a modern way? Who should bear the responsibility for supporting these households and making sure everyone can get online?
And who should do that work? Is that the FCC? Is that Congress? I mean, you have tools at your disposal as well.
True. Our primary tools are from the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Now, I'm old enough to remember 1996. I think you are too.
No comment.
Yeah, there you go. But in 1996, I had an AOL account, was really proud of it. In 1996, there were like these, you know, your phone had this socket in the wall, and then there were these curly cords that I have to explain to the young people in my office. You know, it was a different era. And so our universal service system that the FCC has authority over was built for that era. I think in this post-pandemic world where we believe everyone should have broadband at home, this law needs a refresh.
Mm-hmm. The other major piece of action on the part of the Biden administration is this $42 billion program, part of the 2021 infrastructure law, to build out some of those connections to places that don't have them. That's the BEAD program.
Right.
I know that that is not your agency's primary program. That falls to an arm of the Commerce Department, but it has obvious effects on the work that you do. So I would love your analysis on where we are with the BEAD program now that we're 2 years out from the, 3 years out from the infrastructure law almost.
Right, right. I think we have to remember, like $42 billion with a B, billion dollars is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Washington, it is the most historically significant amount spent on broadband in our nation's history. And our colleagues at the Department of Commerce are using FCC maps to divvy those dollars up between the states to make sure that they use them to reach every household that does not presently have service. I think what's going to be very important in years to come is to recognize we're going to have 50 different state experiments for how we do that. And we should really study so we understand what networks were most effective, you know, what cost structures were most effective to reach all those households that don't have service. So I think the hard work with BEAD is just starting now and making sure we carefully study how each of those states took those funds and used it is going to be a really important accountability effort for folks like yourself.
And how concerned are you that we're going to build all of these networks across the country, but Americans aren't going to be able to afford them at the end of the day? I mean, there's that adage, if you build it, they will come. We know that maybe that isn't the case here. So how concerned are you?
I think that's why the Affordable Connectivity Program is so important. If we're going to build this, we also have to think about making sure it's affordable. And it's why you're seeing so much bipartisan enthusiasm for sustaining this program in Congress. And so we're back to my optimism, but we are going to keep on pressing the case for that for just the reasons you described.
We're also seeing a lot of lobbying on the part of some of these internet providers that don't want to be forced through the infrastructure program to lower their prices, provide some of these very low-cost options to low-income Americans. What do you make of that?
I think we have to start with the strategic goal. The strategic goal is to get to 100% of this country connected to broadband. And then we have to ask if each of these new policies, you know, does its work in service of that goal. And I think that's why we're going to have to look at what's going on with the BEAD dollars. It's why we should continue to support the Affordable Connectivity Program. And it's why we're going to need an assessment of how all these dollars were spent in this post-COVID period. I think we're in a really historically important moment for broadband. And we're right in the middle of it. But the strategic goal is to use all these programs, all these dollars in concert so we reach 100% of us.
The old boogeyman here in Washington is rate regulation, right? Sometimes the internet providers will accuse the government of trying to regulate rates in ways that they view is inappropriate. But why doesn't the government do more to regulate rates in all the contexts that we've talked about, right?
So the history will show that the best way to deal with this is to introduce competition, which pushes rates down. And we are seeing new competition in broadband from fixed wireless services, from satellite services, and I think that's having some effect. But I also think what we have to do in a targeted way is manage this with the lowest income households by making sure there's a program to help support them. And that's what the Affordable Connectivity Program does.
When do you anticipate we're actually going to reach that goal of having universal broadband that people can afford? We sometimes talk about 2030, but is that a realistic goal?
Well, I'm really impatient. I'd like it to be tomorrow. I also acknowledge a lot of that broadband money at the Department of Commerce has not yet reached shovels in the ground phase, but I'm hoping within the next several years. And I'm hoping that the maps that we have at my agency are going to be able to demonstrate that real progress.
Not to be the pessimist again, I feel like the worst person on stage, but we spend billions of dollars on broadband in the course of our lifetimes, right?
That's
through
true.
All of these programs. So what's different about now?
What's different about now is I actually think we are doing this in a data-driven way. You know, it's this old truism, you cannot manage what you do not measure. And for a very long time, we did not actually have maps in this country that showed where broadband is and is not. We threw dollars at the problem, but there was no precision. What we're doing now is we are, every 6 months, marking our progress, identifying where service is and is not. And I think that's what's different about this moment. And it's going to create a culture of accountability that is different than what came before.
Mm-hmm. If I can just end here on an audience question. We actually got one from Australia. You'll have to forgive me, I don't have the name here. But the person wrote to us to ask, if there's a digital access gap, what are the effects that that has on education and civic involvement?
Oh, I think it's enormous. I mean, when I was growing up, if I wanted to do my homework, all I needed was paper, a pencil, and my brother leaving me alone. But right, and you know which one was hard. But anyway, but today every child needs broadband. They can't succeed at school if they don't have that connection at home. So many of us were able to continue to work during the pandemic because we had broadband. 80% of the Fortune 500 companies now require you to apply online. So many more of us are taking those follow-up healthcare appointments. We're doing them virtually. There is so much potential to use these tools to grow our economy and make it more accessible for more people in more places. We have got to seize them. And along the way, we should quantify those benefits so that everyone understands the kind of programs we're talking about and how important they are.
Well, there's certainly a lot in store. Would love to keep talking about it in the future, but we are unfortunately out of time for this conversation. So again, thank you so much for being here, Chairwoman Rosenworcel. And thank you, guys. But please don't go anywhere. We're going to be right back in just a minute with our next speaker. Thanks, everybody.
The following segment was produced and paid for by a Washington Post Live event sponsor. The Washington Post Newsroom was not involved in the production of this content.
My name is Lana Wong, and I'm a founding member of the Diverse Women Moderators Bureau, Moderate the Panel. So today, our issue is how do we bridge this digital divide? And ultimately, it's an issue about equity, about access, about opportunity, and a key part of all of that is affordability. And so as we heard in the previous session, this is where the Affordable Connectivity Program, or ACP, comes into play. It was created during the infrastructure bill rollout, and it is the U.S. Biggest internet affordability program in U.S. history, as we've heard. So Unfortunately, as we've heard as well, it's due to the uncertainty with the federal funding. The future is uncertain. But thankfully, we have someone here to help shed light on all of that and the options for the underserved populations that are affected, because around 24 million people in the U.S. are currently without access to high-speed internet. And that's roughly about 7% of the nation's population, and they're mainly in rural areas and tribal lands. So at the risk of not leaving these folks behind, we really need to address ACP's future. And so let me please introduce Vandana Venkatesh. She's the Executive Vice President and Chief Legal Officer for Verizon. She's been in leadership roles for Verizon for 2 decades and is also a trained lawyer. And I also hear she's a gamer. So welcome, Vandana. So let's just dive in. So since its launch, the Affordable Connectivity Program, ACP, has really been a lifeline for millions of underserved households. Can you just start by telling us a bit more about how it really has helped to bridge the digital divide in this country?
Yeah, so I think, thank you, first of all, for this important conversation. I think this is great. And it comes at a very timely point in time. I do want to say that, you know, gaming probably is the thing that many people, at least my children, care deeply about. And so that's one, at least one piece of having a broadband connectivity that's important. But I want to kind of take us back a little bit. When we go and we talk about broadband connectivity, we need to start with the internet. The internet is one of America's greatest success stories and contributions to what has happened and has changed millions of lives over the last 2 decades. And I think that's important because it's taken a lot of innovation, a lot of investment, and a lot of hard work of a lot of people, including companies like mine, in order to be able to get that out there. And so we're very committed as a company to closing the digital divide, but also to making sure that we provide opportunities for people to use the connectivity that they have. So as you said, there's been a lot of focus around making broadband both accessible and affordable. And in the affordability front, I think the important part of it is we all went through COVID. We all experienced the necessity of having a broadband connection that is both reliable and affordable. And as a result of that, President Biden signed what became the Affordable Connectivity Program through a bipartisan infrastructure law in 2021. And I think it's important then to say, with that, what did people get? And what people got was a $30 government subsidy that was available to eligible low-income households. And that has been hugely successful, with about 23 million households who are taking advantage of that. And I want to just say that the criticality of what we do in Verizon is really to focus and to support that. And we've had a long tradition here at Verizon of supporting customers to close that digital divide through offers, through our corporate social responsibility programs and other things. And we continue to do that because I think it's connectivity, affordable connectivity is very important. But the next step is using that connectivity as well to fully take the opportunities of the digital age. Is important, and time when we're entering an election year, and importance of participating in the democracy is vital.
Right. And so as we heard in the previous session, the future of the Affordable Connectivity Program is a bit uncertain. You all and other providers had to send their customers notices that April would be the last month that they would receive the ACP subsidy. And so this is really dire news for a lot of the disadvantaged households who depend, as we all know, on the internet for their jobs, healthcare, school, you name it. So, and I guess that survey that was also mentioned, I just want to put that stat out there again. It's quite a staggering one. The FCC survey that said that 77% of the households said that the loss of this subsidy would cause them to possibly need to choose between other necessities like food and gas. Mm-hmm. So it is quite a kind of dire and pivotal moment for these low-income households. So can you tell us more about what Verizon has in place to support?
Yeah. As I said, we've had a long-standing commitment towards closing the digital divide. And I want to kind of anchor, I think, on that principle of choice, because giving customers choice among broadband options is really important. So one of the things that we've done is we've had offers in the market for home internet through something called Verizon Forward, which is offered as low as $20 monthly broadband for qualifying customers. customers. Recently, we have extended that to be able to provide a bill credit and make that free for 6 months. And why is that important? I think it's important because consumers don't listen to policymakers and pay attention to what folks like us say on stages like this. They look at their bills. And when they look at their bills, they need time to react, and they need to be able to digest what this means for them. And in order to do that, they need to have choices that they can make. So we want to give them a glide path. So we're offering 6 months free of Fios home internet for new customers who are eligible. And I think that gives them an option to look and shop around, figure out how to avail themselves of their options. But I also want to talk about what we have done historically around our other brands. So on the mobile side, we have a long-standing brand called SafeLink, which serves almost exclusively low-income and value-conscious customers. They've been in existence for more than 25 years. They've had their tagline, coverage and access for all. And they've been a lifeline provider of Lifeline Services, which is the other government subsidy program, for a long time. There, the cost for customers is $0 for a 4.5 gig prepaid service plan. We are now, with the end of the ACP, offering doubling that to about 10 gigabits per month. So we're going to give more data, more options. But we recognize that customers really need options, because not everybody, what we found even through ACP, necessarily is looking for the most affordable options. They want to make their dollars stretch further. They may have other things that they want to do with their broadband. So one size does not fit all, and we have a multitude of options that we're trying to offer to customers to enable us to do that. And I think the important thing that I want to end with on this is that private companies like myself are stepping up through investment and through commitments to make this happen, so that the customers can have an option that to sort of move quickly and clearly from ACP to other options that are available.
Great. And then, is there yet another option or alternative? What do you see for those low-income households who really simply can't afford it?
Yes.
What's left for those households?
Yeah, as you mentioned, so the FCC froze ACP enrollments in February, and this month will be the last full month that customers receive a full month of ACP subsidy. What will happen is it will revert some customers who are eligible to the Lifeline plans, and Lifeline has been a long-term government subsidy that offers about $9.25, a little bit more on the tribal land side, to customers who qualify. And these are customers that are what I'll say, you know, similar to the ACP, but have a lower qualification criteria. So fewer customers qualify for Lifeline than they do for ACP, which does leave some people who don't qualify in the gap. But the goal of all of this is really for private companies like myself to bridge the gap, to continue to offer Lifeline subsidized programs and Lifeline subsidized offers that they can avail themselves of. So I do think that there will be a restriction in terms of the number of customers who can qualify, but we're trying to provide options for our customers to help with that.
Great. But, you know, as we've all been talking about, this issue of universal broadband access has been a strategic goal for federal, regional, local governments for a very long time. And so how can we truly make broadband internet access affordable and accessible to all? Are there ways that Verizon is innovating to try and bring the cost of connectivity down and the rates of adoption up?
Yeah, I think we should look at this broadly in terms of what private companies can do versus what the government can do. We've been in the business of doing socially responsible practices that support business strategy and really enlarging and trying to close the digital divide. As we do that, we've had a number of programs that provide this sort of connectivity. So, for example, through our what's known as VILS, our Verizon Innovative Learning Program, we reach some 500 schools, some about 7 million students through connectivity and through devices that we give to the schools. But more than that, what's important about that program is it offers teachers a way to do something with the connectivity. Because I think how you take the connectivity and really open up opportunity in communities is very important. And so it gives teachers tools, training, tech, to be able to give their students the kind of opportunities you have to do more. And that's been invaluable for a lot of folks in terms of solving real-world outcomes, because we want students of the future to really be thinking about how to solve the big problems of our time, sustainability, technology. So this is an example of something that we have done. So we're in the communities today to support those communities and those folks where they are. Our Small Business Digital Ready program is another one of those. We have supported something like 250,000 small businesses. And again, the goal is connectivity and connection, grant making, but more importantly, connecting small business owners in the communities to others in that community, offering skills that are necessary for a digital age. So I think it is creating a connection, but also the penumbra and sort of the ecosystem of connection, both human and technological, to drive and to give people in those communities options. And lastly, I'll mention, Lana, given your international development world that you've been in, that Verizon was a founding member of the World Economic Forum's Edison Alliance. And that had a very lofty goal to reach about a billion people. And we're already at 750 million there. So that's also about providing connectivity, opportunity, technology to those areas. So I think all in all, the aperture and the approach that we take has to really be much more elevated in terms of what companies can do, companies like Verizon, because we make a lot of investments through our broadband and 5G networks, but we also are doing things in communities to support them and meet them where they need to be.
Fantastic. That's great. But let's now bring it back to the ACP. As we've heard in January, a bipartisan bicameral group did put forward the Affordable Connectivity Program Extension Act, which is proposing $7 billion to continue the ACP. And it was highlighting the fact that it really does provide this affordable high-speed internet to vulnerable groups like seniors, veterans, students. And there are more than 400 organizations that are behind this. So what can we do? What can the general public do to really try and push this forward? And do you think we're too late?
It's never too late, I think. But I do want to start with where we are as a company and what customers are asking of us. So customers ask us, what happens? What can I do? And what we have done is provided opportunities for them to contact senators and congressmen. And we should, as a call to action, everyone here can do that. Everyone listening to this can do that. It's important, I think, to remember that Congress has many priorities. We do, companies that have uniformly in our industry have said that we support funding for the ACP. We support the funding for the ACP. We hope that it will get renewed and it will get extended. But we understand that there are many priorities that Congress has, and this may not make it through. But I think it's important that we step back again and find ways where we can partner to ensure that we have connectivity. And Verizon, as I've sort of said before, will continue to offer choices and options that will allow our customers to take advantage of this. So this is an important moment that I think all of us can lean into, but I think we have plans at Verizon as well to help and support our customers, which is what we do every day.
Fantastic. Well, on that note, I think that is a great way to wrap up and as a call to action for all of us to reach out to our legislators to make sure that we can continue this program, because I think as we can all agree, broadband access is not any longer a luxury. It is essential for modern life. And I think, you know, for many of you in the room, all of us in the room and those of you online, it's something that we probably take for granted, but it is an essential thing for all of us on so many fronts. So thank you again, Vandana, for this important conversation at this pivotal moment. And for those of you online, if you have ideas or thoughts about bridging the digital divide, please add your voice to the conversation using the hashtag #PostLive. My name is Lana Wong, and thank you again for joining us. And I hand it now back over to our colleagues at the Washington Post.
And now back to Washington Post Live.
Good morning and welcome back. I am Abha Bhattrai, the economics correspondent here at The Post, and I am very thrilled to be here today with two amazing people to talk about the next frontiers of the digital age and how we can close the digital divide. I've got on stage here with me Anish Chopra, president of Care Journey, a healthcare analytics company, and Nicole Turner Lee, director of the Center of Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. Anish, Nicole, thank you so much for being here today.
And thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll jump right into it with you, Nicole.
Sure.
So you do a lot of work on equity, technology. You've testified on Congress, as we just saw, that much of the digital divide is steeped in poverty. I want to start there. Tell us what you mean by that and why it's important.
So this is a great conversation to have. If you would have told me almost 30 years ago when I started in this space that we would still be having this conversation, I probably would have told you that this was going to be wrong, right? Because technology has advanced so much, and in ways I think that has pretty much convenienced most of our lives in ways that are also meaningful when it comes to quality of life indicators. But as we saw, and as it was mentioned with the pandemic, we have a long ways to go, right? When the social distancing happened, we found 53 million school-age kids immediately sent home. And it wasn't so much those kids were sent home from districts across the country. We later found out maybe 30% of those kids were from impoverished families, and most of those kids were actually the teachers in their home teaching their siblings about technology as their parents actually worked. It's no secret to many of us in this room that we're suffering the consequences of that when it comes to learning loss. And so one of the things that I've tried to do in my work, I know I don't look older than 25, but I am a little bit older than that. I have a new book coming out on this. It's called Digitally Invisible, How the Internet is Creating the New Underclass, August 6th at a bookstore near you. But the challenge that I actually looked at in that book was in going around the country and talking to families from rural and urban America, what I found was they are at this intersection of race, place, space, and poverty. Mm-hmm. And it's really important for us to see that the folks that we're trying to connect now are those folks that are on not only the wrong side of the digital opportunity spectrum, but they are actually folks who are on the wrong side of housing, the wrong side of economic mobility. And we have to fix that, folks, because it's no secret, and I'm sitting here next to my friend of many, many years, that technology is going to advance and change the quality of our lives.
You mentioned the pandemic, and obviously that changed the picture. Tell us a bit about that. How did that change things?
You know, for someone like myself who started in the Community Technology Center movement in the 90s, when, you know, we saw President Clinton actually advance technology in public housing, the picture for me when I went around the country was not so much a picture of, you know, me opening up a computer lab to young people coming in to play on, I hate to say it, at that time, very analog. You had the 386 computer type technology. The picture that we're seeing today is if you are not connected, you are not connected to areas in your life that will be improved in ways that have significant measure. What do I mean by that? If you're a young person in school and you're unable to connect to high-speed broadband, which is why the importance of the ACP program, you're literally going to be excluded from artificial intelligence efforts. You can't have AI ubiquitously available in this country without making sure a kid across the river here in Anacostia has access. The picture is a farmer. It's no longer black and brown people. In my visits to places like Garrett County, Maryland, which is just 2 hours outside of DC or Stanton, Virginia, people are sitting still in digital deserts. And the unfortunate thing is, for example, for farmers, we're trying to move them to precision agriculture. They're just trying to order supplies. They're just trying to keep up with the competition that has happened over the generations of decline in generational farmers, right, in farming industries. And so for me, this is a conversation that's a little bigger than shiny objects and connectivity. It's actually a conversation on how we prioritize the digital divide and closing it for our global competitiveness going forward.
Anish, you are the president of a healthcare analytics company, and before that, you were the country's first chief technology officer. Why should we care about the digital divide? I want you to expand on what Nicole just said and tell us a bit about how this limiting access can really affect other parts of your life, like health and education and other services.
Well, let me go back to answer this question. When then FCC Chair Julius Genachowski, yes, in the Obama administration was tasked by Congress to write the National Broadband Plan, it's important to note that the plan essentially was cut in half. A supply side part of the plan, which is, yes, the role of the FCC and how we can enable and provide access, but pretty sizable commitment to the use cases.
Yes.
And when you go deeper on health and energy and education, you start to flip the narrative. So a physician who has a homebound patient that's at risk of having exacerbations, right, to their health to come back into the emergency room, societally, we may spend tens of billions of dollars on unnecessary trips to the hospital if we simply could treat that individual, yes, remotely. Mm-hmm. So in those scenarios, what you find, and even in the pandemic, you know, you go to the local high school or a middle school chief information officer, and they would say, give me a list of patients that did not log into school today.
Yes, yes.
And so you can be a lot more focused when you when you bring up the demand side on where the precision challenges are. Mm-hmm. And so part of the conversation we're going to have is, yes, we want to see programs like ACP re-up, but we also must understand more broadly, the more our societal demand signals, the use cases in economic development, health and energy and education, that they may be in a position to help incorporate right. broadband connectivity as part of their yeah. service. And so this movement from a noun to a verb, I think we'll cover throughout the rest of the remarks, that's a huge part of the debate that's often missed when we talk only about the supply side.
That's right. Yeah, I feel bad we met during that national broadband.
Yes, we did. Just a few days ago,
yeah, right.
not too long ago.
Nicole, you talked a bit about how technology and the lack of access to it can worsen social economic gaps. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about cities versus rural areas and what that divide looks like.
Yeah, so I think this is an interesting question, and I've written about this at Brookings for those of you who follow my work. You know, I think that we have created, in many respects, these divides between urban and rural that really may be, you know, more superficial and less constructive, if we really think about it, because the challenges in both types of communities are different. And one of the things that I think that we've done over the years is that we've preferenced one type of community when it comes to government spending as well, which also I think creates these incongruencies in why we talk about rural versus urban. I mean, the bottom line is they both need access, okay? It doesn't matter where you are in this country. If you're in rural, there are more cows than people, you know, potentially the topography comes in the way when it comes to facility challenges. When you're in urban, you live in places like public housing that was built with concrete, you know, walls, or it's hard to get new Wi-Fi solutions because of that. With that being the case, I sort of like to advance with people that we think about rural solutions and urban solutions. And we think about whole communities and where those whole communities make sense for a range of technologies, where they make sense for a range of funding and partnerships, and where they make sense for the people that live in those communities. Having been a person who has worked in community technology in urban areas, visited rural areas, it all comes down to the same thing. People want what they don't have. And as we think about the digital divide as a social determinant, which I can't believe I testified about that and I'm still talking about it, right, as a social determinant of well-being, we have to consider, as we're building both rural and urban infrastructure, that people are going to meet the internet in ways that make sense to them, and they're going to meet them in places and spaces that need to be activated. And I think for a longer conversation, all of us in this room who follow this, we really need to think critically on how we're preferencing funding, and how we're preferencing technologies over the other if we're really trying to make a more ubiquitous, equitable ecosystem.
Perfect. Anish, as we mentioned, you served in the Obama administration. Talk to us about the public-private partnerships in this space, and can the government, including the FCC, which we saw on the stage earlier today, close this gap alone? Where are the opportunities for the private sector and the public to come together?
Thank you very much for this opportunity, because I think it's often lost in the policy debate around telecommunications. So let me remind us a little bit about the opportunities. First of all, when Chairwoman Rosenworcel described the broadband maps, mm-hmm. I want to emphasize this as a public-private partnership, because at the same time, we were subsidizing the deployment of electronic health records to doctors all over the country, urban and rural. But one of the interesting moments was, how can a doctor be forced to have an electronic health record or be penalized for not having one if they lacked broadband access? Mm-hmm. So the regulators said, hey, we'll use the FCC broadband map as an input so that we can be smarter on the regulatory side. So point one is opening up that underlying data is not just for a human to read it, but it's for increasingly machines and innovators to read it, so it can help make very local decisions more pragmatic, number one. Number two, and this gets to the point of the National Wireless Initiative, which was one of the, President Obama's hallmark successes in this area, we did fund R&D efforts. We, as part of the commitment to build the FirstNet Authority for first responders, we put a couple $100 million into R&D, and the theory was, if we could develop lower cost infrastructure, public-private partnership, you know, it's, if you go to a rural area, why is there a Verizon tower
equipment right next to the AT&T equipment, right next to the T-Mobile equipment. Can't they share some infrastructure? Come on, people, can't we share? Can't we share? We could render in software what's in hardware, and we could bring capital costs for last mile connectivity down.
Right, but so, we can do that now. We couldn't do it then because
So you need some R&D,
right,
and you need some market catalyzation, yes, in order to get this infrastructure down. So there is a little bit of an R&D dimension to this. And then I think another aspect of public-private partnership is even with the ACP winding down, we still have Lifeline. There are millions of Americans who qualified for Lifeline then and now that have not been enrolled.
Yeah.
So if you go to the emergency room and they're checking you in for financial services to see if you qualify for a subsidy, why can't they get me enrolled in the Lifeline program? No. Everyone on Medicaid qualifies.
Yeah.
So part of this is that we need an all hands on deck kind of public-private partnership to optimize the benefits we have.
That's right.
While we work to bring about more benefits to accommodate affordability. And so I think these are the simple areas we could have it. And last but not least, we obviously ushered in an unbelievably new, exciting area of unlicensed spectrum for innovation. We opened up frequencies, and there's a lot of activity there. We haven't even begun to incorporate into the planning because we don't know yet what they can do with those high-frequency innovative solutions.
And if I can add to the partnership, too, I think another partner that we often miss, too, are churches and community-based organizations and others who, you know, they opened up their doors during the pandemic, but they're not always considered as a viable partner when it comes to building local digital infrastructure or the ecosystem. So I'm still trying to figure out how do we fund those entities, right, in a way that makes sense the way we're intensifying the market, right? Because there are churches that sat there during the pandemic and they allowed our kids to learn and they vaccinated people, but yet their broadband is really not part of the larger ecosystem.
Let's hope the BEAD program with state funding may allow for innovation and creativity where some states may see the value of incorporating civic institutions that can help bring people into the broadband fold.
We've had a lot of recent breakthroughs in artificial intelligence, and I'm wondering if both of you could talk a bit about how that changes the picture. Does that create more opportunities? Does it create challenges?
If you don't mind, Nicole, maybe I'll just...
This
is an area...
Right.
Well, this is the most exciting era in productivity for the economy, for economic growth, for uplifting. And the early evidence is remarkable. Mm-hmm. Boston Consulting Group, Harvard Business School did a study on knowledge workers, AI as co-pilot, as partner, as ally, boosts the bottom performers up far more than the top performers to become superhuman. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it's a leveler. So one of the opportunities that we see in frankly, one of the indicators I'm mindful of to see if we fail is ensuring that everyone that has their God-given potential can be realized if they had access to the support systems that can give them that lift. If they lack access to broadband, their economic prosperity will be limited.
Yes.
Because this is not about AI the noun. How do I use AI to incorporate a decision about, you know, some aspect of my life socially? It's actually the incorporation of it in the daily life of my economic activity. Mm-hmm. How can it be my, for lack of a better term, partner, coworker, if you will? If we lose a whole swath of the country that doesn't have access to the internet and therefore can't use these tools, we'll miss out a great deal.
Yeah, and I, so in the effort to not sound so dystopian at the beginning, I'll start here. So I do think that AI has this promise that is going to re-engineer our social systems. It's going to level the playing field in some areas when it comes to equity. And if we do this right, it will create the type of environment in which people can participate in ways that will just have enormous breakthroughs. We've seen that in terms of vaccination development. We're seeing that in other areas where AI is, in healthcare in particular, where AI is really doing some tremendous things to include more people. The challenge is it's not democratized, right? So we do have the issue of the digital divide and AI should not be competing interests. They have to go hand in hand. I testified this just recently. If you don't provide the infrastructure to local communities, they will continue to be subjects of technology. In many respects, there are many people who are subjects of digital transformation over decades, right? As we moved into less analog systems. The same thing is going to happen to AI. I also think that it's important in ensuring, and I love what you're talking about in terms of how we're reshifting work, people have to be part of this digital economy to understand how work is changing. Mm-hmm. They have to be part of this digital economy to understand how education is changing. They have to be part of this economy to understand how there are breakthroughs in healthcare that they can actually experience that will level the playing field when it comes to health disparities in terms of remote care management or self-management or individual clinician-patient relationship building. My point is, we've just got to ensure that AI is built more inclusively, that it is not using people as commodities for big products, that it's not making people subjects of the technology, and it's not increasing and advancing bias. We've come so far, I tell you not. I felt like the girl at the prom that nobody wanted to ask before the pandemic, because the digital divide has always been out there, but no one talked about it. Now we're talking about it. But we need to keep talking about that as we also talk about AI, because I think you're so right. It will find its way into our society and our democracy, our global democracy, but we have to make sure we don't disservice the people who have not been able to take advantage of the very basics that technology has to offer.
May I just briefly add?
Sure.
We should constrain inappropriate use.
Yes, yes.
Let me describe for you on the other side how we can encourage proper use. So here's a simple example, and you heard it earlier today. Mm-hmm. If I said I would like access to more affordable broadband, I should be able to ask my AI assistant to say, you may qualify for Lifeline. Mm-hmm. If not, you may qualify for one of the cable carriers or the telecommunications mm-hmm. carriers programs. Or, by the way, you're in a Medicaid program where the plan itself offers a benefit for people that can't afford it, and that's now funded.
Yeah.
Here's the point. We make it so difficult for people to become supercomputers to figure out exactly what they qualify for and how to apply. Mm-hmm. We have to get out of that. And to me, a big part of this is making sure everywhere where there's an application process,
right.
they open the door for my AI supporter to facilitate me understanding what I'm eligible for and what I can qualify right. and enroll in. That may be an area to get AI to be right. used for good while we try to constrain its bad.
Although you keep talking about this universal service thing in Lifeline, we really have to talk about that later. Maybe they need to invite us back. Because to your point,
it ain't a lot of money.
It ain't a lot of money, right? And we need to really think about and revisit. I mean, it is just very unfortunate that in a matter of months, we may see 23 million people de-enrolled mm-hmm. from a program that essentially allowed them to balance budget expenses in their household.
Yeah.
While we can put them on Lifeline, it sure ain't a lot of money that's going to be the substitute for the ACP. And so even though we want to develop these tools, my argument is the tool has to have a landing place that is still going to create democracy, right? Because mm-hmm. we don't want all these folks saying the AI told me to get on Lifeline and I got a little bit of money compared to what I got. We still have to solve the problem.
Amen.
So we're on the same page. But
I got you.
Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure we'll grab coffee afterwards.
Optimize while we fix the ACP budgeting issue.
Well, thank you both so much. I am afraid we are out of time, but we could go on for hours. This was really fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
Thanks.
Us.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.